Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back. You're with Greenwashed. If you've heard anything Don and me talking about in recent times, you've heard us speaking about the Kapiti Coast. We have talked with both the Calm Group, Calm Alarmist Law Madness, and Crew, the Coastal Ratepayers United, often with Salima Padamsi, on what has been happening on their coast and the whole politics of the report that has been presented to their council by a consultancy by the name of Jacobs about how bad this the coastal erosion and the hazards that the community faces there are. Now, today, we will not go into the politics of all of that. We've done that often. And today, we'll go into this report that's now available on Crew's website. It is the Coastal Hazard Risk Assessment Report for the Kapiti Coast. It is produced by Dr. William DeLonghi, Honorary Research Associate at the Waikato University. Now, Willem has a Bachelor's of Science, Master's, and PhD at the University of Waikato and has recently retired after a long and illustrious career there. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Willem.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Now, this report, the way I read it, it's really put the cat among the pigeons. There's Jacob's report in front of the council that is stating that, everything is at risk here. But when I read your report, and I'm no expert, but it's a very calm report that says, right, there is risks, but there is also a whole lot of properties that are going to be all right. There's not a whole lot to be panicking about right now. Would that be correct?
Yes. I mean, to be fair, their report projects things out over 100 years.
Yes.
And I have issues with that because, as international literature shows and a big study undertaken at Tairua Beach by international modellers, we can't actually reliably predict that far into the future. So I've used a statistical approach, which is what the international studies indicate is the most reliable, and done the predictions out to about 30 years for Crew, but I have also taken the time to do a statistical analysis out to 100 years. And so we're comparing things that are slightly over different timeframes, and the scare that comes out of the Jacobs report is primarily related to what might happen 100 years from now.
Right.
Whereas I focused on what is likely to happen in the next 30 years. And the other issue was that the modelling that was undertaken, unfortunately, didn't actually simulate coastal erosion, which is what the claims were about, but simulated flooding using two different approaches, one of which is not appropriate and gives excessively high levels of flooding.
So the report that the council currently has done by Jacobs, which has cost a pretty penny, as I understand, it has used the NZCRISE tool. And you mention in your report that MFE, the Ministry for the Environment, has put away the disclaimer that the NZCRISE tool should not be used for, you know, long-term modeling purposes. And yet, as I understand, or am I incorrect here, that they've used a tool that is not appropriate?
They used a mixture of the MB recommendations from some time ago and some updates from the IPCC AR6 report, because the CRISE tool effectively became available by the time they were finishing.
Right.
But in subsequent presentations and discussions, they've kind of referred to that to justify what they did. The difficulty is that the CRISE tool and its publicity implied that sea level assessments around New Zealand didn't take into account vertical land movement, which technically is correct, because the assumption was made that our relative sea level rise was approximately the same as the global absolute sea level rise, which is what the computer models predict globally. That assumption was fine, but I'd always argued that we needed to separate out what was due to the land movement and what was due to things like global warming, ice melt, and all those other things people are concerned about. So sea rise is good for doing that, but we need to recognize that all of the planning and work that's been done has been based on the measured sea level at tidal stations like Auckland and Wellington, Christchurch, Dunedin, the main ports. So we've always been working with relative sea level for our actual planning. Where the problem has arisen is trying to predict the future, and the computer models don't take that into account. So sea level is not actually rising faster than we measured because we measured it correctly. And that's kind of led to an inflation of what future sea level might be. And Jacobs has done that, but not directly because they've taken MBIE's data and therefore have followed MBIE's guidelines.
So, just for clarification, Willem, are you saying that one can generalize about sea level rise globally?
I'd argue no, because the different ocean basins behave differently. So coming up with one single level is inappropriate, and the IPC recognises that. So actually, when you burrow down into it, they have slightly different projections for the different ocean basins, and they have slightly different projections by latitude. And so we can say that, the islands in the Central Pacific that are supposedly being, at huge risk due to sea level rise actually have a much lower risk than countries at the latitude of New Zealand if sea level rise is in fact an issue. And so that single global number is not appropriate. And we have the sea rise program. Itself has analysed the rate of absolute sea level rise for New Zealand, and it's in the order of 1.4 to 1.5 millimetres per year, whereas the assumption is that it's 3. So you can see already there's a doubling of what's actually occurring built into the projections for the future. And so one of the things I show in the report is that we are now at the stage where we can actually test quite rigorously whether that has happened or not. And so we can see that the actual sea level rise is below the trend of the projections, which started in 2005. And more importantly, if we burrow down, in order to achieve those projections of future sea level rise should be accelerating at a rate that's much faster than we actually observe. And so at the moment, I am reasonably confident that we aren't seeing sufficient change in the rate of sea level rise to achieve the projections.
Well, and the layman in me says, I read your report, and I certainly have once over lightly, to be fair, of the 120 odd pages. But I see some graphs, and I look at it. They start at the year 2000, and you no doubt could have gone further back. But there's the trend line, even to my eye, doesn't match even the most risk averse. Sorry, the most. I know that you'd use the term. I've got to think about this the opposite to the way you present it. Everyone's using conservative
So no,
modeling,
unfortunately.
which gives the worst effect. I'm talking about the opposite of conservative. Even the best case scenario doesn't show a significant rise in water level, sea level rise.
And so part of the thing to point out is that for my predictions out to 30 years, none of the projections really differ terribly much. So if you want to compare what was done by the IPCC projections or what MBIE have chosen from them, there's not a lot of difference between their most extreme and their most least extreme scenario. And what statistically I'm saying is a continuation of the historical trend. And so my view is that for planning purposes, MBIE should be recommending that as a naive, basic, simple projection for the future, you should extrapolate the existing trends. So we say what's happened historically, we'll take that as our baseline. Unfortunately, they tend to use the least conservative scenario, the 2.6, as a baseline. So they already have inflated what's happening.
Right. And so that's a nice way of presenting my very ordinary question. I understand that much better with that explanation. Thanks. Because boy, I was struggling with seeing those graphs and thinking, oh, are my eyes telling me something different to what everybody else is sort of trying to tell me is really happening there? So thank you for that explanation.
And you would think, Dr. DeLonghi, after such at the expense and such a long process, Jacob's report, the technical issues that you point out, and I'm going to read a couple of them. You say that Jacob's assessed coastal erosion and inundation hazards, assuming different scenarios of sea level rise, but ignoring sea level fall due to vertical land movement. The effects of other drivers of coastal erosion and inundation were not specifically assessed. It also assumed that the anthropic impacts would be restricted to removing coastal protection structures as they exceeded the design life, did not consider any mitigation or adaptation measures, and assumed there would be no changes to infrastructure apart from the loss of coastal protection structures during these 100 years. That is, in one word, bollocks. Why would we be taking these sort of assumptions that there'll be nothing done over the next 100 years?
I mean, I can't answer that. That was their decision, and the methodology that they used. They got agreement from the council that it was appropriate, and they've also got an agreement from MBIE that it's appropriate. So it's an issue because the same approach is being used throughout the country. And as I said, the real key thing is that we cannot predict 100 years from now where people will be living. What will have happened to the coast? Here at Kapiti, it's tectonically active. There is a reasonable chance, in fact, GNS say there's an 80% chance that in the next 50 years there will be a major earthquake,
Right.
which, in my opinion, is a pretty high probability. And that's going to potentially completely change the elevation of the shoreline. And we can't predict what that will be and when it will happen. So my suggestion to the council is that they go about it slightly differently, and it's a methodology which is in the MBIE guidance, so it's not, controversial or silly or just solely me. And that is to look at the historical trends and use statistical methods to predict a reasonable distance into the future. So 30 years, I think, should give plenty of time to do something if you need to. And identify, importantly, the trigger points at which there are problems based on a cost-benefit analysis. So, at what time do you really have to force people to leave? I mean, in my view, it's unnecessary to get people to abandon the coast now for something that might not happen before 2110, So the 100 years in the future, we may have a totally different population structure. There may be other issues. 100 years is time to gradually encourage people to leave or to buy up properties rather than doing it all en masse. So I think there are lots of options that are available when you think about a longer time frame than trying to front load all of the responses to the future events in the next decade, which is what some people appear to be trying to do.
Right. And just to give some context, the Kapiti Coast coastline, I think your report talks about 7% of it is currently eroding.
Yes.
Most of it along inlets or unprotected areas, as there's about 20% protected, and there's 70% of the coastline free of erosion. So
Yes, and interestingly, at the time I finished my report, the Coastal Change Unit at Auckland University also released their website. It's on live. You can go there, and their numbers are identical to mine. And there is another website that's now available that uses satellite data that updates the erosion trends for the whole world effectively every time there's a new set of satellite imagery, and it's showing exactly the same thing. So and KCDC, the council here, have their own surveys. Their data shows exactly the same thing. So it's clear that at present, the problem doesn't exist, but as I told the crew AGM yesterday, I mean, the critical thing for the council to think about is that section of coastline which is currently protected by seawalls. And they need to decide whether it's to the benefit of the community to maintain those seawalls into the future, or whether it's more beneficial and more cost effective to force those people to move because they have to go somewhere. And if you move them, you need to create new infrastructure for them. They also need to consider the overall hazard landscape because moving people from one area that's hazardous to another area that may be just as hazardous is not actually beneficial.
Another basic question then is the seawalls were put in since 1940 for a reason that obviously the locals thought there was going to be coastal erosion. Based on your studies today, would you still concur that those seawalls were necessary based on the knowledge that you have now, or are they unnecessary in that 20% of the coastline?
Well, before this interview, I had to wander along the seawall to have a look at things. And in the 10 years since I last wandered along the seawall, the beach has accreted, which is what the data was showing. The reality is that they could actually dispense with the seawalls if they could encourage the dunes to recover. And the real problem that underlies all of this is that when people arrived in New Zealand, they disrupted the dune vegetation. And we had two phases of that occurring at the Kapiti Coast. And the most disastrous one was the European one because of the introduction of grazing animals. And the response to that with the 1903 Sand Act was to plant marram. And so we have a total change in the characteristic of the dunes. And so the marram dunes are high and steep. And unfortunately, marram is not strictly a four-dune plant. It is not tolerant to salt water. So it gets killed by salt, which is a bit of a problem if you're trying to use it to stabilize dunes in the four, in the area that's exposed to salt water. The native vegetation, on the other hand, likes salt water. It derives nutrients from it. It likes being buried, and so it grows faster when you have burial associated with storm events and erosion. The restoration processes, people are getting better and better at it. But from the sort of reviews and stuff that we've done, we need a minimum of 8 meters of space that's dry sand, it's above the tide, to get these dunes established. And they need to be established before there's a storm. And currently, you don't have that along the Raumati coast. So a long-term plan could be to buy up the first line of properties and then re-landscape the dunes to provide space so that instead of having the high steep dunes behind a seawall, we have a zone of the lower natural dunes. And that could provide protection, but the critical thing is something I pointed out 10 years ago, is that there needs to be a study and analysis of where the sand is coming from, and also, more importantly, in the area that's eroding, where it goes to. So the fact that the beach has recovered in the 10 years since I was last there tells me that there is still sand coming into that area. What needs to be done is to find an effective way to trap it and build up a barrier to the sea, which a seawall won't do. So
It's
there are a range of options that I think are available to the council as long as they move away from the mindset that we're in imminent threat of losing hundreds of properties and extensive erosion. And unfortunately, I think not only Jacobs, but all of the preceding studies which used the same methodology have exaggerated the threat. And that I think is a bit of a problem.
You put it so simply, Dr. DeLonghi, that this is what, even to a layperson like me, this would seem the most obvious thing. You first stabilize the beach, the sand dunes. And so you are saying in the 10 years since you first suggested this, there have been no studies at all undertaken?
Not that I'm aware of. I haven't seen anything published. There was a thesis done by Victoria University, which has been quite useful, but they looked at the prehistoric evolution of this area. And so they are suggesting that this area started eroding about 400 years ago. If that's the case, then there's something fundamental going on that occurred before, the climate change crisis and all of those sorts of things. And we need to understand what they are. So there's been that study. There's been a study also from Victoria University that's been looking more closely at the faults and the vertical land movements. And so we now have evidence that's pretty good to show that the southern area, which is eroding, is currently actually rising out of the sea. And so if sea level is driving it, we would expect, this area was not eroding, but this is the area that's eroding the fastest. And the area to the north is sinking and therefore should be eroding badly if sea level is the critical factor, but it's accreting. So all of that indicates that it's the sediment supply that is the
Variable there.
key thing that needs to be quantified for this area.
And this
And
is
you
exactly why, sorry, Don, you say in your report that a single VLM value, virtual land movement value, for the entire coast is meaningless. It's not
Yes.
realistic. Parts of the coast are going up, the other parts are subsiding. And but there is this insistent, is there not, to find right, we need a figure for the VLM, for the virtual vertical land movement. And this is never, I mean, you can theoretically do as much as you like, but practically that value is meaningless.
Yes, I mean the sea rise program, which used satellite INSAR data to estimate the movement around the shoreline, shows quite clearly that on short stretches of shoreline things are going up and down. But we knew that anyway from the continuous GPS data. The issue is that the continuous GPS data, some of the longer ones are 20 years or more, but the sea rise data is 8 years. And they've played around with it a little bit for the sea rise that they removed some values they decided didn't fit the story. But the main issue is that it's 8 years worth of data, and some of the places we've checked is the INSAR data can't distinguish between the land moving and things like constructions of new buildings. Or the one which is quite impressive is the massive subsidence at the mouth of the Waikato River, which is associated with the mining of sand for Glenbrook. So it just doesn't tell you what causes the change in surface elevation. And as they note, there are various issues with the processing. So the paper that presents the analysis that provided that data shows that it's work in progress, and I commend them, and I think it needs to be improved, and in the long run it's going to be very useful. But to take 8 years of existing data and say this is what's going to apply for the next 100 years is foolish. So that's why I've argued for a statistical approach, because the shoreline change that's been measured here, and it's the data goes back to the 1870s, so we have a long set of measurements of what the shoreline has done at the Kapiti Coast. Even if we say, okay, it's only good data since World War II, it's still 70 years worth of data. We can use that to predict 30 years into the future, and we have implicitly included all the effects of changing weather patterns The frequency of storms. So arguably all the things from climate change, we've incorporated the effects of differing rates of sea level rise, changes in sediment supply, and the effects of humans, which are quite significant in terms of building seawalls and training the inlets. So all of that has already been factored into the shoreline changes we've seen. And so if we just assume that those things are going to behave much the same way for the next 30 years, then we get a reasonable idea of where the shoreline's going to be.
A question, again, going back a little bit, is tracking the sediment movement. Were you sort of indicating that the sediment could be coming from even outside the Kapiti Coast area, or is it all localized sediment movement?
No, we have the South Taranaki Bight. So from Mount Taranaki down to the Kapiti Coast, we've got all these rivers coming out. And what I showed in the study from Victoria University that recently came out really highlights it, is that the growth of the Kapiti Coast is not continuous. It's what we call punctuated progradation. So it grows outwards and we have some storms and there's some erosion that goes backwards and then it recovers and it goes seaward. But every so often we have big pulses of sediment and there is massive growth. And so those seem to be associated with the really big eruptions in the central volcanic region. So the last one of those was the Taupo eruption. And then we have some smaller pulses. And those also seem to be associated with large floods bringing sediment to the coastline. And one cause of those are the lahars off Ruapehu, for example. So we had that in 1953, and it looks as though that sediment pulse is just at the northern end of Kapiti Beach, now around Otaki. Then more recently, with the recent lahar events, you know, there's stuff that's coming out the Whanganui River and heading down the coast. And then somebody who got the first honorary doctorate, DSC from our department was Pat Grant, and he's worked on the rivers of the Manawatu and showed that there's this pattern where we have periods of increased rainfall, which we're kind of seeing at the moment, and periods where there's less rainfall. And that results in phases of erosion in the headwaters and sediment is carried down. So we get pulses of sediment coming through. And all of that moves, due to the wave climate, southwards along the coast. So it's not a continuous supply, which is why I think it needs more study, because we need to figure out, you know, is what's the extreme, what's the largest amount we can expect, what's the smallest amount, is it going to increase or decrease in the future? All of those things. But it moves down the coast, and that's why everything north of where I'm sitting here at the moment, at Raumati, is accreting. And the problem is that if we model the future and assume that miraculously that's going to stop as soon as we publish our report, which is what previous studies did, that's nonsense. And in the case of Jacobs, they've kind of changed it a bit. They've assumed that at some point their erosion prediction, which is really a flood model, gets to the point where accretion will stop and everything will start eroding. That might happen, we can't tell. The problem is that they've assumed that it's not accreting until the point where it starts eroding. So I can compare my predictions for 50 years into the future with their predictions, and following the existing trends, the shoreline will be seaward of the current one. And according to theirs, it stays static at the current position until at some places in 50 years' time it starts eroding. And that I think is entirely driven by assumptions. So I haven't made any assumptions other than things stay the same. And they've assumed all sorts of things which I detail in my report.
Yeah, some very convenient assumptions there.
Well, inconvenient for the residents.
Yeah,
but convenient for those, as you say. This is, you know, some of the most obvious things, like looking at the dunes and what practical steps could be done there before telling everyone that you need to move out. And even before that moving out step happens, people are facing some very tangible issues trying to sell that property, insure the property, mortgage a property. For many people, all the wealth that they had collected for their retirement, it's bound up in their property, in that asset. And
Yes.
when there is no reliability, no certainty about the value of that asset, for me, it's like your life's savings just gone down the drain, all because of these assumptions.
Yes, I mean, in this case, and I didn't present it yesterday, but we can do a reality check. So we know where the shoreline was in 2017, and we've got Auckland University that worked out where the shoreline is in 2022. And it's seaward, so the shoreline's advanced in the areas that are accreting. And you can go to Google Earth and you can have a look at it there, and you can go to their time tool and you can see the same thing. So it's clear that accretion didn't stop in 2017. So immediately that assumption's invalid. And so it concerns me when we're predicting the future based on scenarios and assumptions, and we don't evaluate the likelihood that that will happen. And so I make that point, which gets rather technical in the report, that if we want to assess the risk, and insurance companies claim, you know, that they're going to use this data to set your premium, you need to know the probability that those assumptions are valid. So statistically, I've done that, and that falls out of the statistical approach. But with the process-based approach that's been used for the report, the underlying assumptions have not been defined in terms of probability. And so we have the use of scenarios that are now implausible because there are no pathways that can achieve them, and ones that were, as originally defined, supposed to be a exceptionally unlikely upper limit. And I, in my opinion, something that's exceptionally unlikely or is implausible doesn't meet the requirement of assessing the likely future effects. And I think there is, it's probably something that has to be looked at from the national level first, and driven from there, that we have to look at the sensibility of setting rules in place that are actually unworkable because we cannot reliably predict the future that far in advance. It's like requiring that our hospitals are set up to deal with the demands of the population 100 years from now.
From now,
For and for diseases and pandemics and things that we don't know nothing about.
you refer to a few of these assumptions again and multiple times in your report. One of these is being using the RCP 8.5 scenario, which, when it was created, was defined as being exceptionally unlikely, and that is something our Ministry for Environment is still continues to use. The other thing that you point out in the report, Willem, is that the KCDC, the Capital Council, it needs to determine what is an acceptable level of risk. And you point out that at present in the Kapiti Coast District, it seems acceptable to be subject to a 1% AEP. So that's annual exceedance probability. So a 1% AEP flood risk is fine, but it appears that it is unacceptable to have marine inundation to be subject to a 0.01% AEP, annual exceedance probability. So there is contradictions there. One particular year flood event, you are happy to accept that 1 in 100 years, but for marine inundation, you are not happy to accept a 1 in 1,000 years. So what?
So I way back, my very first case in the High Court in Rotorua was in 1984, and we had this issue for Ohewa Harbour, where the people that lived seaward of what was defined as the tidal limit were had to deal with a much lower acceptable risk than the people who lived upstream. So if they were deemed to be in the freshwater part of the estuary, then 1% was fine. And if they were in the tidal part, then that wasn't fine. And this is still perpetuated today. One of the consequences of that is I suggested that there should be a standard 50 centimeter freeboard for floods, which is what the freshwater people had. And that ended up being turned into the sea level rise value that was used for a number of years in New Zealand. But yes, I think you need to be consistent, because if you're going to get people to move managed retreat as a result of the hazard, then saying that people on the dunes at the coast should move because of a coastal erosion issue and move onto the floodplain, where it's okay to get flooded, and during all this time that I've been involved in this at Kapiti, no one's been affected by erosion, but a lot of people have been affected by flooding. So that's why I think you need to look at all of the hazards and do a proper cost benefit analysis and say, and think about, where do you shift those people to? And having shifted them, are they now in a more hazardous situation or not?
Have you made them worse off? And
Oh,
you
gosh.
clearly point out it's just 7.8% of the properties, totaling to about, is it 50 roughly, that might be at risk?
Yeah, I think it's a bit less than 50.
Whereas.
And I should also point out that these are properties that experienced erosion in 1976 through to 78 and are now protected by seawalls.
So not recent then.
No. So
Just.
there has been some events where seawalls have failed and there've been little patches of erosion. Since the construction of essentially continuous seawall from southern Paraparaumu down to the Kiritu Park and then through Paikokoriki, the erosion has not been a major issue.
Well, we can all relax, go home, it
Wow.
seems.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I
I
mean,
mean, it is dependent on those seawalls being maintained. So
right.
it's not currently an issue, but if the seawalls fail and wandering down, it's clear that in the patch I looked at, there are two layers of seawalls. There is one that I presume is the council. And at times the waves break over that because we see large driftwood debris on top of the seawall, and the residents have another a seawall at the base of their property. So yeah, there is a lot of cost in maintaining that, and there are all sorts of things to think about, whether it's borne by the community or borne by individuals, but that gets into politics. But it's a sort of thing that I think can be resolved if we're not going to try and rush into a predetermined solution, which appears to me to be the strategy at the moment.
And that's a very good place to perhaps conclude this interview. Otherwise, we will get into politics, and we promised we wouldn't. So, you've simplified it for us. You've given a 126-page report to the crew team, and you're going to present that to council as well, I gather, or maybe at least have a discussion with the council about it.
Yeah, I don't know the details of what will happen on Tuesday, but we'll see what happens.
Right. So, look, I think the Kapiti Coast resident should be grateful that you've got your report out there, and the crew team are doing their level best to make sure it's getting the traction it needs. And we just thank you for coming back on RCR a year on and talking about it, because none of this is easy.
No.
But those of us that have got a bit of an engineering bent know nothing's insurmountable either. But we do need the facts at the start.
Yes. Yeah, well, as I pointed out at the start of my talk, I was born in the Netherlands. My family have occupied a hold reclaimed in the Rhine River Delta since 1169. So I don't view anything as insurmountable.
There you go. And that's even a better place to conclude. Thank you very much for coming back on RCR Greenwashed, Willem. And we'll watch this with interest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered.
visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.